All right, everybody, welcome to another edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast. It's host E. Marcel Portut. Got a really exciting show for you. Going to talk about some college football, NFL action, preview UFC 165, and other miscellaneous news and notes in the world of sports. But first, get to our sponsors. We are always brought to you by the sportsinquirer.net, the premier news site for any information in the world of sports. Some really good articles up this week, recapping this past week in college football, and also a good preview of this upcoming week in the NFL. Some really good content there. Expect to see some information, a recap of UFC 165, and also some more football news as well. So look forward to seeing and writing all of that content on the sportsinquirer.net. Also brought to you by the startinglineup.net. Partnership with my cousin Lisa, who has a really good site and radio show in Chicago, and doing some work with her as well. So expect to see some of my content there as well. So go check out the startinglineup.net. And finally, we're going to also give some love to the girlslockerroom.com, another site developed by an associate, Amber, kind of a mix of ESPN and TMZ, kind of like a sports gossip. If you're into the urban gossip sites, and also usually ties into sports as well. So really good site that launched within the past, I think the last 2 weeks it launched, and really good content there. If you're into the lives off the field of some athletes and just some other fun information, go check out that site. Once again, it is thegirlslockerroom.com. All right, let's get to the show. All right, welcome back to the show, Sports Inquirer podcast. Of course, starting off this week and looking back last week to the college football schedule, have to always go to the Alabama-Texas A&M game. Several thoughts on that, and I'm just going to go through some bullet points, and I think when I go through all of those, you'll see all of my thoughts on the world of college football. First thing is Nick Saban is mentally paying for Johnny Manziel to go pro, and yes, the pun is highly intended there. Let's look at Johnny Manziel's past two games against Alabama, who has arguably the highest regarded defense in all of college football. He dominated them in Tuscaloosa last year, and in this game against Alabama, which the Tide actually won 49-42, he had 562 total yards of total offense, which for some teams, they can't get that in three games against Alabama. For all of the offseason drama that Manziel has gone through and that his attitude and all of the alleged activities that went on with his bank account, he's still the most talented player in college football. The way he dominated that Alabama defense, and yes, there were two interceptions there that you would not like to have, but if you're grading on the scale of elite performances, it was right there. And the last time I also saw a performance like that against for a team in a losing effort and that high caliber of a contest, it was when Michael Vick went against Florida State back in a national title game several years ago. I'm not comparing Vick to Manziel. If anything, Manziel might actually have a little more accuracy than Vick. I don't think he's as fast as Vick, but that's another argument for another day. But I think Manziel is definitely going to go pro after this season ends for both on and off the field purposes. And I think Nick Saban is very proud or happy that he's not going to have to deal with them ever again. And speaking of it, I think when you look at Manziel, not only is he going to be a pro player, I think he's going to have a solid career and start for multiple years. I think when we look at the reason, and you're listening to this podcast right now, is we've all become media experts in we've all become media members in how we look at college players. And I think with the unprecedented television viewing access that we have in 2013, Many college fans, we've all put on a Mel Kiper Jr. or Mike Mayock hats when evaluating the skills of a player. When you look at a player such as Manziel, we're looking at his professional skill set and how he's going to be in the professional level and not how he currently is playing in college. And I think when you start doing that, you start skewing what your perception of the player is going to be. The biggest example of this was obviously Tim Tebow, who's the first in the modern generation to become the polarizing figure that Manziel is currently experiencing as a quarterback in the most high-profile position at a high-profile school. I think Manziel, when he finally leaves college, which I think will be this year, is going to have one of the best two-year runs ever for a college quarterback, not only statistically, but for skill-wise. Now, is he going to have the national championships that the Tommy Frazier's, Charlie Ward, Tim Tebow's, and you go down the line of all the A.J. McCarron even, all of the college football greats in the quarterback position that we've seen in the past, say 20 years, just go back to maybe 1993? Probably not. I don't think A&M is going to win a national title this year. But he is going to have a solid career in the NFL. We're going to get to our NFL thoughts in the next segment. But look at the guys who actually got the starting spot. Week 2 of the NFL season. Chad Henne, Geno Smith, Christian Ponder, Terrell Pryor, Jake Locker. All of those guys started games last week in the NFL. Some actually came close to pulling off a win. If I had to choose Manziel in comparison to all of those guys, and granted, I know we have not seen Manziel at the pro level, it's a different animal, I would take Manziel over all those guys I just mentioned for various reasons. So for all the talk of he's not going to make it in the pros, not only is he going to start for a few seasons, I think he actually has a chance to be a productive player because the dearth of talent at the quarterback position in the NFL, while the top level is very, very high, the bottom level is just as low. And he's going to find a spot somewhere for some team. And maybe Mike Evans can find a spot in the NFL as well. And if Mike Evans becomes a first-round draft pick, which if he performs the way he has in the first two games of the season, he needs to cut Manziel a check for those efforts. I'm still sticking with my thoughts that Ole Miss will beat either Alabama, LSU, or Texas A&M this season. I know that they got that big win over Texas on the road, and that's really not that impressive in these days, and we're going to get Texas in about 30 seconds. But I'm sticking with my thoughts that the Rebels are going to nip one of those teams. I see A&M as that potential team that can really get messed up because of the lack of defense from the Aggies. Alabama and LSU, not only are they scoring productively, it looks like the LSU is finally looking to use the forward pass and be productive. Now, granted, they have not had the TCU is actually a decent team. I shouldn't say they're not the stiffest competition. But we're going to learn a lot more about LSU in 2 weeks when they come to Georgia. But going back to Texas, the Mack Brown should be fired talk. That should have happened years ago. I've never been a fan of his. I think he's a respected coach, solid coach. But if you're looking for someone to play at a national championship level, he is not your man. When you win only two Big 12 conference titles in 12 seasons and you're the University of Texas, that's unacceptable. Critics like to mock Bob Stoops and his bowl record while being at Oklahoma and the moniker Big Game Bob kind of being played out. But at least he wins conference titles and gets to the big game. They've only played for two national championships while at Texas, while he's been there. And while we always have this debate with people where expectations versus reality for your program and where your school is, for Texas, two national championship appearances in the game, that's not acceptable within a 12-year span of a coach being there. He needs to go, and giving up 550 yards to rushing to BYU 2 weeks ago was bad enough that he ended up firing Manny Diaz as defensive coordinator. And Diaz is a prime example. We're going to get to another guy, I think, that is a better example of this. So maybe this is prime A or prime B of this situation. When I was living in Nashville about 4 years ago, one of the hottest names in college football was Manny Diaz. He was the defensive coordinator at Middle Tennessee in Murfreesboro, which is about 30 miles outside of Nashville. So we were very familiar with him if you were a sports fan and working in sports media like I was. And then he got the promotion to believe he went to Ole Miss for a little bit, and then he went to Texas. And the star has fallen greatly. He's a young man. I believe he's not even 40 years old. So he has potential to still have a very productive career. Just the past 2 years at Texas since he was hired there have not been good. And you fire Manny Diaz, who's a respected young coordinator, and replace him with Greg Robinson, who was an utter failure at two institutions. He was a failure at Syracuse. He was a failure at Michigan. And he was the television announcer for the Longhorn Network, serving as a consultant. And you expect him to come in within 6 days and change that defense around? Well, I guess you could say Ole Miss only ran for 272 yards against the Longhorns, but they still lost at home 44-23. When you're outscored at home 27-0 in the second half against a slightly above average SEC team, and that's me being very generous of calling Ole Miss an above average team, the players have quit on the coach, and they've quit on the program. And we're not even the Big 12 play yet. They still have to play Oklahoma. So they've got to play Oklahoma State. They have to play Kansas State. They've got to play Baylor. They still have about 4 or 5 losses possibly in them. Now, as Texas, they'll probably end up finishing around 7-5, maybe 8-4. But that's still, that standard is not acceptable for him. So he's going to be on his way out and let the Nick Saban rumors to Texas begin. Dan Mullen is a fine coach, but you have to win that game against Auburn. Mississippi State is currently 1-2 and still has Alabama, LSU, Texas A&M, and a suddenly upstart Ole Miss team on its schedule. That means the Bulldogs cannot afford to lose games when they're facing someone like Arkansas, Kentucky, and Auburn, and teams of that level. The thing about it is, it wasn't a good look for the Bulldogs. And I said 1-2 is something that you don't want your team to be. But the stories of the Bulldogs getting rid of Dan Mullen, they're unfounded. He is the best coach that has ever been at Mississippi State. And yes, I'm aware that Jackie Sherrill and his baseball cap were walking down the sidelines in Starkville, and he took him to a few New Year's Day bowls. While that's great and everything, the way the competition is now in the SEC, the depth of it, and the spreading out of talent, for him to be able to get them to multiple bowl games and win several of those, Dan Mullen's the best coach they've ever had there. Now, I talk about Texas and expectations and reality and what should they be. If Mississippi State wins an average of 7 games a year, they should be happy with that. It is arguably the second worst job in the SEC. I don't want to say what I think the worst job is, because that'll hurt my alma mater, and I don't want to say it out loud. But you look at the resources, the talent base that you can recruit from, and a bunch of other factors, money particularly, Mississippi State is, as I said, I think the second worst job on paper. Now, I think you can win there and win some bowl games, but if Mississippi State expects to compete for a division title or SEC West or even a conference title, that's just not going to happen. Now, I know it hurts that Ole Miss has gotten a little bit of a run here, got the top recruiting class, one of the top ones in the country, and I've won some high-profile games under Hugh Freeze, but that should be enough, I think, to Ole Miss should just worry about being respectable and not getting rid of Dan Mullen. Now, A.J. Darby was leading passer for Arkansas in his win over Southern Mississippi last Saturday. He finished the game 4-for-6 and with 36 yards passing. Ryan Mallett and Tyler Wilson, who were the previous quarterbacks in Arkansas, they would have done that in one drive under Bobby Petrino. Brett Bielema has really changed the culture of Arkansas. Now, granted, they've played some cupcakes at home, and when they get to the meat of the schedule, we'll see if they can keep the persistency of rushing for 200, 300-plus yards in a game. But I saw that stat of seeing a starting quarterback from Arkansas only going 4-for-6 for 36 yards. That was interesting. Connor Shaw is not going to make it through the entire season if South Carolina keeps using the mentality of him getting more rushing attempts than Mike Davis, who was a stud of a running back. I said after the South Carolina season opener against North Carolina that the Gamecocks insist on using an offensive plan where Shaw runs the ball more than 10 times in a game. He's not going to make it through the season. when you look at the statistics of their win over Vanderbilt on Saturday, he had more rushing attempts than Mike Davis. Now, I know a lot of those may be some sacks or some dives for no gain and a few draws, but it's so much easier just to hand the ball off to your super sophomore running back, who looks like he's going to be another in a great line of Gamecock running backs that we've seen over the past few years. You have to look at the future, and you have your senior quarterback running so many plays. He took some serious shots against Vanderbilt, and he took some against North Carolina. Now, I know they like Dylan Thompson as a backup, but you don't want to have that be your option to go to your backup. Let's get to my top 10 teams in the nation, midway point of my review. Number one, I have Alabama, of course. They're the best team in the country. Number two, I have Oregon. Solid win over Tennessee. Number three, Clemson, who's actually playing right now at this moment. We're recording a late podcast, and they're down 7-6 in the second quarter. Typical Clemson. Looks like they're going to struggle on the road against an inferior team. Ohio State is 4. Stanford is 5. Texas A&M I still have at number 6. Florida State is 7. LSU 8. Georgia 9. And Louisville 10. So that's my top 10 ranking. Teams I just missed out. UCLA, impressive win over Nebraska. South Carolina, we kind of delved into. Miami, quietly with a 3-0 record, making some moves. Granted, they haven't stepped their foot outside of the Orange Bowl, but it's the right progression that they're making. Oklahoma State and Northwestern are also teams that I considered for my top 10. I think it's time for Jerry Kill to retire. He's a solid coach who's trying to rebuild the Minnesota program and trying to get them back to a respectable level, at whatever you term that being for Minnesota football. But seizures and epilepsies are scary issues, and they go beyond football. I don't like the kind of passive tone of all of the announcers and players, or the announcers and even the administration of Minnesota, saying, oh, he just had a seizure, he's dealing with epilepsy, like he sprained an ankle. I'm all for trying to do your best to compete to win and do the best for your program and do for your players and represent the university. But there comes a point where you have to have a humane bone in your body. He's not going to retire. He's not going to quit. If I was a Minnesota administration, I hired him. I would not bring him back as a head coach. I would take care of any medical issues that he may have, because he is a part of your community. He is a part of your program, and he has contributed to building Minnesota. But he would not be a head coach on my sidelines, because I don't want to be morbid and talk about a man dying, but if he continues to lead this path, he's going to have a really bad incident, and I'll leave it at that, during one of these games, and the liability will be squarely on the Minnesota administration. I would blame them for it. I blame him too, because he's a grown man, and he should know how to take care of himself and realize the risk of his condition. But when you look at it overall, a lot of the blame and the liability, and as I said, liability, because it would be a legal nightmare for all parties involved, it would go to Minnesota. So seeing them have another incident on their game on Saturday, as I said, I would not deal with that at all. Bo Pelini. There are two things you cannot do as a head coach, especially at a college football program as storied as Nebraska. First thing you cannot do is alienate the fan base. The second thing you cannot do is alienate the alumni, especially former players. And I guess you could bump those together. You can't alienate people, and then you can't have lack of wins. They believe Nebraska's lost, 10 games at home under Bo Pelini since he's been there. Or maybe it's Mac Brown is one of them. I'm mixing up my stats. We keep it honest here on the Inquirer. You cannot curse out your fan base and then single out and criticize maybe the best player to ever play for that program. And yes, I know Trev Alberts was there, and Johnny Rogers, and a variety of other, Mike Rozier, Urban Fryer. You can go down the list of all the great Nebraska players over the years. Tommy Frazier may have been the best college quarterback that I've ever seen. I said college quarterback. I'm not going to debate what happened after he left college. But as far as he was the best option quarterback I saw, I'll definitely give you that. Best option quarterback I've ever seen. And if I think that being a guy growing up in New York, living in Georgia, I can only imagine how he's revered in the state of Nebraska, where he won multiple national titles. You cannot just alienate the guy and brush him off. Even though Tommy Frazier does need to mind his business a little bit, I'll give you that, and I know the coach feels that, and I feel that too, but you just have to have a better approach when dealing with him. So when Bo Pelini is fired at the end of the season, which he will be, and I think it'll be less about the stuff off the field, the cursing out the fans and criticizing Frazier. It's going to be more about them not being more successful than 8-4 every year. While that's solid and it's good to be an 8-win team, you got to see progression beyond that at a program like Nebraska. So that's where he's not going to be there much longer. I don't care how much the national media wants to spin it, and of course they do it so they can get the ratings and talk about top teams. Notre Dame is not a top 25 team. I saw some of that game against Purdue, and that's not one of the 25 best teams in the country. He saw what happened when he went to Michigan. The defense, I'll give them credit. I like Lewis Nix. I like Truitt. They got some ballers up the front seven, or the front four, I should say, strong. The defensive line. The back linebackers in the secondary, respectable. Tommy Rees as quarterback and the rest of that offense lacks dynamics. They're not a top 25 team. They'll be lucky to win 8 games this season. I see you throwing 4 touchdown passes badly for Georgia Tech against Duke. I see that. And then finally, rough week for the state of Florida, outside of Central Florida, who got that big win over Penn State. Going to be at that South Carolina game in 2 weeks, which will give me a really good up-close view of not only South Carolina, but if Central Florida can actually not only compete for the American Athletic Conference championship, but maybe can they be undefeated? Can they maybe bring a national title to Orlando? A lot has to happen, of course, with that, but we'll get to them a little bit later. South Florida, who just badly lost us Florida Atlantic, and were also humbled by McNeese State. Willie Taggart, it's the first year. Man, that cupboard is bare in South Florida. Only about 5 or 6 years ago, they were a top 15 program. Jim Leggett had them cooking, and they were doing work. I don't know what's happened. At Florida International, got defeated by Bethune-Cookman 34-13. That may be the worst loss that I've seen, relatively speaking. I know Florida International is not a major player, and not even a team in a major conference, if you look at the BCS, non-BCS argument, if you go by that stuff. And I don't know Bethune-Cookman. They may have a top team for that level. That's not only... That's beyond a fireable offense. That may end the... It's not going to end the program, but it's going to take a while for them to recover from that type of loss. So, while Florida State, Miami are doing their thing and trying to get to national prominence, some of the other teams of that state need to step it up. So those are my thoughts on college football. If you have any for me, please hit me up on Twitter under Sports Inquirer, all one word. And then also send me an email at sportsinquirer@gmail.com. When we come back, I'm going to get to my first edition of the Zone Blitz with my NFL picks, here on the Sports Inquirer podcast.
Hello, Brendan.
Welcome back to the Sports Inquirer podcast. Host E. Marcel Portsuit. Didn't mention it in my college section, but I'll hit it right now. Story came out today. ESPN.com actually broke it, or some other outlets have did it as well. The deadline to submit proposals for the 2016 and 2017 national title games is September 27th. It's fast approaching, and some interesting cities have placed a bid to host it. The usual suspects: Glendale, Arizona, New Orleans, Miami, and also Pasadena for the Rose Bowl. So the big four BCS bowls threw their hat in there, of course, to host that game, going through the formalities of it. Some other interesting names, or teams, or cities. All right, cities. Jacksonville, Tampa. Obviously, the Florida presence is very strong during bowl season, so it's no surprise that those two teams with NFL facilities threw their hat in there. Minneapolis is actually no. We'll get to the other cities that are looking, let's say, official cities. That's a Jacksonville, Tampa, San Antonio with the Alamo Dome. They're starting to make their presence felt in some regular season games there. San Francisco, obviously that new stadium that's going to be in San Francisco where the 49ers are going to be. They're going to host something. And then the stadium in Dallas, the Cowboys Stadium, which I think is going to host the first game of the new BCS system that's going to be developed. One city that was missing from all of this is Atlanta. And for those of you not from the city of Atlanta that haven't been able to follow it as much, there's been some major issues with building a new stadium for the Falcons, which in turn would also be used for potential events like the BCS Championship. The fact that they did not submit a bid, I think, speaks majorly to an issue of them getting that stadium built, which is bad news for Atlanta. For the Falcons, if they're trying to build a stadium and they can't even put a bid in, that's really a major story to check out. And I said, this just broke a few hours ago. So those are my initial thoughts on it. I'm sure by the time I do my next podcast next week, there'll be more news in relation to it and some more sources kind of in the back rooms and the background about what's really going on. And we'll get to that, of course, next week. But I thought that was an interesting thing to talk about as far as the Falcon Stadium and the struggles of them getting that built. All right, let's get to some NFL action. Interesting first 2 weeks of the season that we've dealt with. We've seen Pittsburgh look like a 4-12 team. Tampa looks like it's going to release its quarterback and or head coach by the end of the season. Matt Castle may be the answer in Minnesota. And then there's talk of Denver going undefeated. But I want to start off with my picks, and the game is actually going on right now. Philadelphia and Kansas City. Philadelphia favored by 3, and I took the Eagles in my – I wrote the issue or wrote my article earlier this week. While I think much ado has been made of Andy Reid's return to Philadelphia, which is fair because he's the best coach they've ever had in that franchise's history. And I know Dick Vermeil was there and Buddy Ryan, they had their moments. But he was able to build that offense that Chip Kelly, the personnel that has been able to take advantage of Chip Kelly's offense. Michael Vick, the reclamation project that we all know about. DeSean Jackson, who I thought would be too small to play in the NFL. McCoy, who I was not a big fan of when he was at Missouri. And all three of those guys have turned into very solid pros. So respect to Andy Reid for putting that together. But he also put together that defense, which is the worst in the NFL. And that's where Philadelphia is third in the league in points per game. But they're giving up a whopping 30 points per game on defense. Only two teams I've seen who have been successful to a Super Bowl level, winning games 35-30, are the 1999 Rams or the 2009 Saints. And that's a once every 10-year thing. Now, maybe the Eagles will be the exception to the rule, but I don't think they have the capabilities of pulling that off. So I think for tonight's game, The Eagles are going to score just enough points against a Chiefs offense that has improved with Alex Smith and the return of Dwayne Bowe from injury and Jamaal Charles. But I don't think it'll be enough points for them to get a win. For fantasy purposes, I hope Jamaal Charles goes off for 250 yards total offense and gets me to go 3-0 my fantasy season. But I don't think that's going to happen necessarily tonight. So that's my thought on the first game. Tennessee and San Diego. I'm taking the Titans minus the 3 points. With the struggles of some other quarterbacks, such as Sam Bradford, Blaine Gabbert, Cam Newton's up and down rookie season to his second year, a lot of people have taken their eyes off of Jake Locker, who's in his third year, and has shown minimal improvement since he's entered the league. All people talk about the top players from his era, the past 2 years. Obviously, the big three of Luck, Russell Wilson, Colin Kaepernick, RG3 as well. You include him indefinitely. Locker's in that same category, and Christian Ponder, who we'll get to in a little bit. Those two guys, Locker and Ponder, were just in that same category as those guys, and they have shown no progression as professionals. But I think that the Chargers are going to need another. It took the Philly defense, Eddie Royal channeling his inner Jerry Rice, for San Diego to win a game at Philadelphia. I don't see that happening again, and I think the Titans behind Chris Johnson get that victory minus the 3. The Vikings have major issues on both sides of the ball, and I've never trusted Ponder as a quarterback. However, they're facing the Browns at home. Now, I've seen the spin. I've read the articles. There was a good article on Grantland.com about the way this trade is good for both teams, for Cleveland and Indianapolis. And from if you look at it from the general manager side of things and the Browns getting another draft pick in the first round for 2014, I can kind of understand some of that. But you also just traded away a top 3 pick from last season. Yes, I know Trent Richardson has averaged only 3.5 yards per carry in his career, which is very pedestrian. But he still has the talent to be one of the best running backs in the league. If you're talking about this rebuilding project and getting better and doing all this stuff, you're going to need a running back. And I know we've undervalued the position of running back so much where it makes it seem like we just get anyone off the street to produce. But you still need to have a talented guy back there, and it's tough to find. And you just gave away one of those guys for a draft pick for next season who may be a bust. Or it could be a superstar. But that risk, I don't think, was worth it overall. So I think for this game, I'm just going to take the Vikings minus the 6. New England, I'm taking minus the 7 at home against Tampa. The Patriots have their own issues on offense, but the Bucs are a complete mess. So I'm just going to take New England in that one. Very surprised to see the Texans 2.5-point favorites on the road at Baltimore. I know Ray Rice has his injury issues and the Baltimore offense has not been as consistent as you like, but I still think that the Ravens are going to put together a win at home against a Texans team that's improved, but I don't think they're going to win that game on the road. Dallas minus 3.5 against St. Louis at home. Take the Cowboys. I won't say that's the easiest win on the board, but it's pretty darn close. Take the Cowboys. New Orleans at home, minus 7.5 at Arizona. This game can come. I can see it going one of two ways. I can see when I'm watching one game, and then all of a sudden you look up at the scoreboard, and it's New Orleans 24, Cardinals 7 in the second quarter. Or I think it could be a fight to the very end. I'm personally going to take the Saints to win, but not by 7.5. That's a pretty big number. And I know the Saints are outstanding at home. For some reason, I'm just going to take the Cardinals on the road in that one. So, Arizona plus the 7.5. Washington minus 2 at home against Detroit. I see the criticism of Robert Griffin III And I was skeptical of, I'm not a doctor, I'll admit it, but I was skeptical of him coming back from a major knee injury, not playing in any preseason contest, and then coming back in the regular season at full strength, doing all the stuff he was doing last season. I think that was way too much to ask of him. And I heard all of the people, including my family involved, saying, oh, it's just a ACL. You saw what Adrian Peterson did. That was one man. And Adrian Peterson, genetic figure of the highest regard, highest level. But not everyone is built like that. Every surgery in every case is different. I think Robert Griffin III is going to come back eventually and be just as strong as ever. But it's a lot to ask a quarterback to only come back, come two games in, into the season, less than a year for major surgery. I don't care how far the medical advances are, and just bounce back and be normal. That's a lot to ask. But the biggest problem with Washington, though, has been the defense, which has been surprising because the defense was respectable last year, top half of the league, and they get Arakpo back. You would think that would increase the help. But looking at the, and arguably, yes, they face Philadelphia and Green Bay, two strong offensive units, but that's not a reason for them to look as bad as they have. I'm going to take the Redskins to win that game at home against Detroit. Green Bay -2 on the road at Cincinnati. Very tricky game. And I see what the odds makers are trying. They're trying to bait you into going that Green Bay way because they're a favorite. I'm still taking the Packers -2 over Cincinnati. Bengals are a strong team. Andy Dalton, I'm a little mixed on, but that defense is nasty. AJ Green is a stud, arguably the best wide receiver in the NFL. I said arguably. People down here, if I mention that, they get all sensitive. What about Julio Jones? He's the best. He's the future. I think AJ may have a chance to be even better than him when it's all said and done. But both of them are outstanding players. That's another debate for another day. Going back to this game, though, I'm taking the Packers -2. That might be the sucker bet of the week, taking a road team -2, the favorite, but that's what I'm doing. The Giants, actually Carolina's favored by 1 at home against the New York Giants. I'm going to take the Giants +1. It's pretty much a pick'em game when it's -1, when the line is only at 1. The Giants can't keep turning the ball over at this rate. And Carolina, I really don't know what to think of them yet. So I'm just going to take the safe bet and take the Giants. Because if anything, we know they can throw the ball a little bit. And the defense, while not looking the best against the Broncos, I think they have enough to stop the Panthers from doing a lot of things they want to do. Last few games here. Atlanta, I'm taking them +2.5 on the road at Miami. Surprised to see the Dolphins a favorite at home. I know they had a nice win over Indianapolis. They won on the road against the Colts last week, but a favorite over the Falcons, a team that is one of the top teams in the NFL. And I know Steven Jackson is out for this game and maybe the next week or two. But I'm still going to take the Falcons. They're going to score enough points to secure a late victory over the Dolphins. San Francisco -10 over the Colts. That's a lot of points. I'm going to take San Francisco. They're going to get healthy. They had a really rough go of it up in Seattle on Sunday Night Football last week. I think the 49ers are going to win that game. And I'll say this about Trent Richardson, kind of tying it back to Cleveland. If he stays healthy and keeps his act together, being traded to the Colts may be the best thing for his career. I think he can rush for 1,000 yards for the rest of this season. I don't know how much playing time he's going to get this week, but I think if so, I'll say he gets 1,000 yards with the next 13 games, which isn't really hard to achieve for him. As I said, I think the Colts look like a respected organization. You have a stud potential quarterback in your backfield. That's going to help out so much. The Cleveland Browns offensive line outside of Joe Thomas, and even he's kind of been a little inconsistent lately, their offensive line is brutal. The Browns organization is brutal. You're going to a Colts team indoors, Andrew Luck, clear direction. That's going to be outstanding for his career. He's going to have a really good impact there. But for this week, 49ers win by more than 10 points. I can't take the Seattle Seahawks to win by 20 points over the Jacksonville Jaguars. The Jaguars are the worst team in the NFL. They're terrible. Seattle has the best home field advantage in the NFL. That's still too many points, though. There has to be a letdown from that Sunday night game against San Francisco and then seeing the Jaguars come in. Trust me, the Seahawks are going to win this game, but not by the 19.5 points that the odd makers have. Buffalo is going to be traveling to New York. I think Buffalo hosts that game, excuse me. But the line is 2.5 in that contest. The Bills just have more talent. I'm going to take the Bills. Buffalo wins that. If you remove the Steelers' colors, their track history, and looked at them purely from the prism of 2013, that's a 6-win team, and that may be generous. The Bears have shown some life so far this season, and I know the game is in Pittsburgh, and it's national television, and anytime you put that together with Jay Cutler, that can always be a recipe for something odd, but I'm going to take the Bears to win by 2.5, at least by 2.5, over the Steelers. So that's what I'm going to do. And finally, Oakland, Denver, Monday Night Football. Denver's at home favored by 15 points. That's, once again, a lot of points to be laying at home. I know Oakland has had their issues, but I don't know if they're that terrible. So I'm going to take the Raiders to win that Raiders are not going to win outright. Heavens no. Broncos are going to win, but not by the 15 points that the odds makers have it. So those are my thoughts on the NFL season so far and picks for this week. You know how to hit me up if you have any thoughts on that. And we're going to take our next break here and get into some UFC MMA talk here on the podcast. Welcome back to the Sports Inquirer podcast, host E. Marcel Portsuit. All right, going to really quickly go over UFC 165. John Jones versus Alex Gustafson for the light heavyweight title. Maybe the first fight in Jones' career or the first time in a long time that he's going to be in a fight against a guy who's physically maybe superior to him as far as reach advantage, height, and size overall. Usually Jones, who is a massive light heavyweight as far as the physicality goes and the reach advantage, which he uses the best out of anybody in MMA, Gustafson is just as capable to use those tactics against Jones. While I think Jones is still more skilled when it comes to the punching and kicking and overall boxing, Jones uses kicks very well. And that's where you see reach goes beyond your arms. It goes to your legs as well. He has very long legs that are capable of reaching guys who like to keep their distance. I'm going to take Jones in the fight. Third round TKO. I think you're going to see him want to really finish a guy and get it done in a pronounced way. He wins this fight, he'll defend his title, light heavyweight title, more than anybody in the history of the sport. So that's a really nice accomplishment for him to strive for. I'm going to take Jones in that. Bantamweight title on the line, Renan Barao versus Eddie Wineland. I'm going to take Barao. The guy hasn't lost in years. Incredible, talented guy. I'm going to take him to win the fight I'll go decision. I'll say it goes to 5 full rounds. Wineland's no joke. He's a physical guy as well. But that's my prediction with that. Finally, in the, I guess, the another kind of co-main event or just right below it, Matt Mitrione versus Brendan Schaub. Two guys who are in their 30s. Schaub is 30. Mitrione's 35. I won't say it's a put-up or shut-up time for those guys, but if they have any aspirations of being a title contender, they really need a win in this fight, both of them equally. So that's where I'm going to actually take... I've been flipping back and forth with all of this. I'm going to take Schaub, which I don't know if that's an upset. I have to look at the odds, but I'm going to take Brendan Schaub. I think he does a little bit better job on the ground, a little bit better wrestler, and I think he'll get the win there. So those are my quick UFC 165 thoughts. Plenty of analysis, of course, when the fights after the fights actually happen on Saturday, and we'll get into that next week on my next podcast. We're going to take one last break here, and when I come back, I'm going to hit on some miscellaneous news and notes in the world of sports here on the podcast. Welcome back to the show. Just some miscellaneous things that I've noticed over the past week. I must admit, I have not actually seen the Canelo Alvarez Floyd Mayweather fight. I usually find a source to view it. Honestly, you just go to Showtime or HBO and watch the entire fight. So I don't want to be unfair and be an injustice and give my analysis of it because I did not actually see it. I don't like talking about fights or events that I have not at least seen to have some opinion on. But I know that you look to me as a fan of combat sports, which I am. I just have not even looked at the fight, so those aren't my thoughts. I don't have any thoughts on that. But it looked like, from what I'm reading, looks like Floyd kind of did what he does, used his defense and his jab, and coasted to a victory. So those are my thoughts on that. Reading the reports of the World Cup, which were awarded to Qatar, I guess for 2020, I always get my years mixed up. It looks like the FIFA president, which Sepp Blatter, is saying that it may have been a mistake giving it to the Middle Eastern country. Of course it was a mistake. If you follow international soccer, the bribery and the blatant criminal activities to gain these votes is deplorable. They knew it was a mistake to not only have it in a country very controversial in their policies, but also looking at the heat and the temperature of the games when they happen during the summer. I don't understand why they just don't do another vote or recast. I know that may set a bad precedent, and it's always about precedent when it comes to things of legal natures, which the awarding of World Cup is, but they need to make that correct. And finally, I'm happy to see that Montreal is going to get some baseball games next year. Looks like they're going to get two contests between the Blue Jays and the Mets next March. Now, I have to see if they're actually regular season games or if they're minor league games. But they're exhibition games. Okay, they're exhibition games. They're going to be at Olympic Stadium. I always used to like, as a Mets fan, Montreal was in the same division, NL East, as the Mets. I always liked the dynamic of having a Canadian team in the division, a little something different. One of my goals is my traveling, and I'm gonna do some traveling towards the end of this year, and then next year we have some major plans to go to some fun places. I don't want to say them out loud because there'll be some conflicts of interest, and I'm not really ready to deal with that. We'll cross that bridge when we get to it. But I've always wanted to go to Montreal. Maybe part of that's my French background. Obviously, having a name Etienne Portout, or Marcel Portout, my middle name, I have a French ancestry. So I'm always intrigued by French-Canadian culture. So Montreal, obviously, is the center of that. But also, I think it's good just for diversity of the game when people look at diversity, a lot of times it comes in two ways. They look at diversity in gender, and they look at it in the racial aspects, which is fair as far as diversity goes when you're looking at sports or anything in life. But I think location is very important as well. And I think that's what that makes the beauty of sports, is when you have representation from many different aspects of cities. I like that you have a team in Chicago that may be different from a team in Los Angeles, or teams in Midwestern cities like Kansas City or St. Louis. You have the Pacific Northwest with Portland and Seattle. Even down in Florida, they have their own culture and way of things of doing it. So I think having a teams in Canada and Mexico, for that matter, obviously, I don't want to get too political, but obviously with security issues and other things with having a Mexican professional team, if that could be resolved in some way, I'd love to see that as well. So having a chance to have Montreal maybe get their foot back in the door of Major League Baseball, even if it's only for two exhibition games, is a proper step for continuing the evolution of Major League Baseball and beyond. So I'm glad to see that those games are going to happen. And Quebec is definitely going to enjoy the province of having some baseball back there. All right, we're going to end the show on What Ruffled My Feathers. I think my last Ruffling the Feathers section, I talked about a grown man taking a self picture in the gym and how that shit is unacceptable and a violation of many blatant man codes. Well, at the same gym, the way I keep talking about this gym, you think I should leave it. It's actually a really good gym. It does what I have to do. But I am tired of people walking in front of me when I'm lifting my weights. Now, I'm not saying that I'm the next Arnold Schwarzenegger or Lee Haney or Jay Cutler and I'm putting in work, or Ronnie Coleman benching 400 pounds and doing squats of 600-700 pounds and I'm like a big bodybuilder dominating the scene. But I'm lifting some pretty heavy weights. I'm benching some 60 to 65 pound dumbbells. I'm curling about 40 pounders. I'm actually putting in some heavy lifting, trying to build my muscle up. The last thing that I need is for another person, when I'm trying to do my bench press or my shoulder presses, to walk right in front of me while I'm doing my lifting. And I think it speaks more to an overall tone of personal space. I'm not a big personal space guy per se, where you have to keep your distance from me all the time and you can't approach me and I don't like hugs or handshakes. I'm okay with physicality as far as touching goes. I'm not a Howie Mandel type, and as a best unfair to Howie, I don't have issues with touching people or standing next to somebody, but I still need my space. And that's when I'm just standing there. I don't like it when I'm standing in line at the supermarket waiting to check out and a person is standing literally right behind me. When you can hear the breath of someone from behind breathing into your ear, that's a problem. When you're driving your car and you look out your window and you see someone is tailgating you, that's a problem. So when you're in the gym lifting weights and trying to get your body right and trying to be safe, and that's when it's all about safety, when someone is walking in front of you, while you're in the middle of your set, that's not right. Now, you should be able to walk in front of somebody if they're in between sets. That's fair game, because you have a job to do. You're trying to get your lift in. You're trying to take care of your business. I have no problem with that at all. But it is my policy, and I take it very seriously. If someone is lifting in front of me, even if it's on a machine, I wait until they finish their set before I walk in front of them. I have walked around people and made myself inconvenienced so that someone can have the space to take care of their business. And it was the same guy today, too, doing the whole thing. And first of all, I didn't like him because he had that kind of smirky look. And when I get in my lifting mode, my beast mode, I think I could take out anybody in the gym. So that didn't help the cause, obviously, that I was kind of amped up, got the testosterone going. But there's still a matter of respect when you're in a personal space with somebody to let them do their thing. And it happens so much there. And it's not only him, and it's not just a man thing or a woman thing. It's all ages, all types. That's why I prefer not to go there when it's crowded. I love being the only one in the gym. That's like, I get a little bit of a mental high when I see that. And it wasn't that crowded today, but he was really just bugging me. And you don't want to say anything and be that guy to be mean and annoying. But seeing that happen today reminded me of personal space and how we need to respect each other. And he's lucky I'm not the one that'll try to beat him up or try to cut him or something. Because being from New York, I've heard the stories. I've seen it. I've literally seen guys get punched in the face just for standing next to somebody and looking at them more than 2 or 3 seconds. Now, that's just not just a New York thing. I'm from there, so I have more experience with that. But you got to be careful, man, with violating people and getting too close to them. And as I said, the gym was an example of it, but also being in the supermarket and being in your car tailgating, those type of things are really, really bad. And just having the experience today reminded me of that. All right, thanks everybody for listening to the podcast. Host E. Marcel Portute. As I said, we have some excellent content on the website, Sports Inquirer, thesportsinquirer.net, over the next few days. This weekend, not going to have too much on there, but next week, starting on Monday, we're going to go right back to the routine. A lot of football, a lot of mixed martial arts, and everything in between. Did not talk professional wrestling, and I'm watching TNA Impact right now, so I have plenty of wrestling thoughts as well. So all you wrestling heads out there, hit me up there. And if you want me to talk about a specific guy or specific organization, I'm game for it. I watch it all. So until next time, have a good, safe, productive, fun weekend. Stay safe out there. And until next time, good fight, good night.